It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Open Concessions podcast presented by Toyota. That's right. We have a new sponsor. So thanks to Toyota for its support. And we feature a weekly in-depth conversation with a Chicago Cubs-related personality. We are your hosts. I'm Len Casper, along with Jim DeShays. He's my television partner, and hopefully we will be on television here in the next month or so. More on that a little later today. Hey, JD, how's your week going?
Hi, Len. It's going great. I have relocated to a place on the river. We have way up in the northernmost part of New York State. And winding down a couple weeks here, this is where you can't do anything but socially distance here. It's very remote up here, but it's been great. And we're heading back to Chicago this weekend. How are things in your world?
Okay. We've had a lot of rain here the last couple of days, and the heat and humidity of August has hit Chicago here in mid-June, but that's okay. Summer has arrived. Today's guest is Hall of Famer Billy Williams, one of our all-time favorites. Billy was the National League Rookie of the Year in 1961, a six-time All-Star. He won the Major League batting title in 1972, 426 career home runs, and he had basically a 1-to-1 walk-to-strikeout ratio. Pretty amazing. 18 years in the Major Leagues, 16 as a Chicago Cub. JD, we will talk with Billy a lot about his career and some of the greats he played with and against. But about the first half of our conversation is about what's going on in our world, and it's some pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah, Billy was born in the rural South in Alabama. He grew up with segregation. He signed a professional contract at the age of 18, right out of high school, and off he went. And he had to deal with a lot of racist idiots, to tell you the truth, and just institutional racism. And it's just heartbreaking to hear those stories, but they're important stories to hear. And it's obviously a big part of his history and his legacy and many others who played the game in that era. It's just a wonderful conversation with a great man.
Well, let's get right to it. Enjoy our chat with sweet swinging Billy Williams. Hey, Billy, thanks for doing this today. How are you?
I'm doing fine. After the corona thing and after the funeral yesterday, I'm doing fine. Everything's good. Just protecting myself and protecting the family and making sure everybody come in the house to see Shirley, wear a mask. So it's a thing. It's kind of easing up now. I'll be glad when they find stuff, man.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. We will talk some baseball today, but after the horrific death of George Floyd, which you mentioned, we've seen daily protests throughout the country against police brutality and for equal treatment for minorities. What are your thoughts about what's going on right now in our country?
Well, I'm looking at that, and I'm just looking at what happened on this particular time. I think, because people had cameras and people began to have cameras in the last few days. And I think the brutality has been going along a long time. But all of a sudden, people standing around now, you could get the camera and shoot what's going on. So it's a rough time in the life of a black person now.
Billy, you strike me as a very optimistic person. Do you lose hope? Do you lose optimism when you see this and it's gone on for so long and it keeps rearing its ugly head?
Well, I am because of all of the protests in the past You know, you see a lot of people protesting. But now when you look at the protests, you see kids from, I guess, from 18 years old to 25, and black people marching, white people marching, brown people marching. And I think we're at a crossroad now. And I think something going to happen out of this. I really feel that it will, because so many people standing behind what's going on. I see, it's a funny thing, you know, you see white people with signs above their head say Black Lives Matter, which we know, you know, and this is what's got to happen. Everybody got to get in on this and have conversation about where we go from here.
You dealt with a lot of this stuff very specifically, and we can get into that here in a second, but I'm curious about your grandkids and the conversations you're having with them and what they've experienced. I would like to think that they've had it a lot better than you did, but we still obviously have a long way to go.
This is true, Lynn. I think, you know, when they come over to the house, we sit down and we talk, and they know that things happened with me when I first went off to play baseball, and I tell them about the incident, many incidents that happened. But I guess at that time, I looked at the big picture. I wanted to play the game of baseball. And, you know, when you look at what Jackie Robinson went through, I just got a ripple of it. Many different places I went, and I was called names. Sure, I was called names. Down in Parker City, when I first went off to play baseball, you talking about a lonely individual. I was the only black person on the baseball team. So I had to travel around, and people had to go in restaurants. I couldn't go in a restaurant to eat. And fellas, Jim Brewer was a real good friend of mine. He pitched for the Dodgers, and he was from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. And we got along real well. And he used to go in the restaurant, and when they went in to eat, they would get their food in there. So he would make sure that when he come out, he bring me food on the bus, because I couldn't go in the restaurant to eat.
Mm. You know, this is a tough one. You've always been yourself since I've known you.
Yes, I have.
But I'm curious, when you were 18 or 19, did you feel like you had to adapt in certain circumstances and maybe not be yourself all the time? Because, you know, when JD and I get on a plane now, just in terms of culturally, right, you've got a lot of Spanish speaking players, and you hear the music, and, you know, everybody kind of has their own little thing that they're into. And if there's a moment in time where you're into something and other people don't understand it, and you feel like that could cause problems for you, I'm curious how you dealt with that.
Well, you know, the thing is, I was raised up in the South, so I knew where to go, when to go. And as I move up the ladder to play Major League Baseball, play baseball, there were times, you know, you look at it culturally, different guys have their different culture, what they do. You mentioned, you know, the Latin players have their culture. And some of the white boys, they be together and they, you know, do things. And of course, the black guys do their thing. And it's an adjustment. It's an adjustment for white guys, an adjustment for black guys, because a lot of times individuals play the game of baseball, they haven't been around too many blacks. So they have to make an adjustment too. And it's a constant adjustment for both parties when you're in the sporting world, when you're playing team sport.
Right. When you went to Ponca City, when you first signed out of high school, I mean, you left literally like 2 days after high school, right?
I did.
You're 18 years old and you go off to play ball, and then you have to deal. And you know, being from the segregated South, you were aware of the way some people thought and behaved. But now you're out there as a young man trying to earn a living in a world and people are, you know, just treating you so poorly.
You know, one of the things, JD, when I left to go to Ponca City, and I was thinking Ponca City is beyond the Dixon line. I didn't think Oklahoma was segregated when I left home, because I was young and not knowing too much about what's going on out in the world. And I remember boarding a bus 2.5 days. I'm riding 2.5 days, and I was picked up at the bus station, and I was taken to these individuals' home. It was a private home we were staying at, and at that time, Lou Johnson, Sammy Drake, guy he lived here, Chick Greenwood, passed away, and Gilmore, and you know, it made it kind of easy, you know, when I walked in the house, you know, met these individuals who played with Ponca City. That was my first year, 1956, right after I finished school. But the second year, when I went to Ponca City, I was the only, as I say, the only black kid on the ball club. So it made it tough traveling around, but it you know, it was tough, but there's some adjustments, sure, you have to make.
Did your identity and the fact that you weren't always put in a very comfortable situation actually, in some ways, make you the ball player you turned out to be?
I think so. When I started out playing baseball, and I see the prejudice stuff that went on while I was playing baseball. And I began to look at the big picture. I wanted to play the game. And I remember when I was in 1959, I was at San Antonio, Texas. And after playing for a couple of years, I said, I'm tired of this game because of all the things that happened, you know, waiting on the bus. And it happened then, waiting on the bus, driving back from different cities. I had to sit on the bus and wait till people bring me food. J.C. Hartman was my teammate at the time. We had to sit on the bus until people bring food. And I just got tired of it. Grady Hatton was the manager. And I asked J.C. when I got back to the hotel, I said, Jay, take me to the airport. Take me to the train station, matter of fact. And J.C. said, where are you going? I said, I'm going home. I'm tired of this stuff, man. Yeah. But he said, I'm not going to take you, man. You serious about going home? I said, yes, I am. He said, you are serious, ain't you? I said, if you don't take me, I'm going to catch a cab. So he said, I'll take you. So I went home and stayed for about 7 days. And in the meantime, I was making so much progress in the organization because I'm hitting over 300 at that time down in San Antonio. And Grady Hatton was the manager. And normally JC and I would ride to the park together. And when I didn't come to the park that evening with JC, and Grady Hatton asked JC, where was Billy? And JC said, he's going home. So it was a big thing at that time because I was making so much progress. And John Holland, who was the general manager of the Cubs, he got in touch with Buck O'Neill. And for about, you know, a day and a half, I was home doing my thing, fishing and just enjoying life. And Buck O'Neill used to drive a Fury all the time. So I saw this Fury coming up in the yard, and I said, oh, I'm in trouble now. So Buck came down, and we talked. We enjoyed life. He took me down to where I used to play baseball. And I stayed home for about a week, so I went back. And Buck convinced me to go back, so I went back into San Antonio, and things began to look up at that time. I began to enjoy baseball a little bit more. I had to make some adjustments, so I was looking at the big picture at the time. I looked at myself making the progress that I had made, and I said, might not be long. I could play Major League Baseball. So I started looking at the big picture, and it all worked out.
You know, sure, Billy, excuse me, Len, but Billy, you've used the term make adjustments three or four times now. And most players, when they talk about making adjustments, it's, you know, to their batting stance or, you know, going to learn a new pitch or whatever. You're talking about, and I'm reading between the lines here, but the adjustments you're talking about making is living in this system that you can't go into the restaurant with your teammates and just at some point going, okay, I'm just going to have to live with this. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you must have been seething with anger, but you still said, okay, I this is what I got to do to get to where I want to be.
Yeah, this is what I'm talking about. You know, when you look at what I went through and what you look at what Jackie Robinson went through, I guess that was a wake-up call when he came to the big league, and he had to make some adjustments, and that's what I had to do. You know, as I come in, my culture and the white culture was two different things, and I had certain places to go, and I couldn't go different places to really enjoy things. So I had to make an adjustment, go somewhere else, go to the black motel, and where I could really have a lot of fun.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I was just thinking about your life and your career, really, you know, paralleling a very important time culturally in our country. You mentioned Jackie. And the big last speech he gave, mm-hmm. he talked about a black manager in baseball, and he passed away, I believe, before Frank Robinson was hired to manage the Cleveland Indians. I think of 1968.
Yeah.
You were a Chicago Cub at that time, but there was a lot of upheaval in the country. How much did you pay attention to what was going on in the country? Not specifically related to the game of baseball, the Civil Rights Act in 1964, 65. I mean, that whole era. How did you follow that?
Well, it's a lot of stuff happened in the 60s. And being from Mobile, Alabama, I remember I didn't move to Chicago until 1966. Therefore, after the baseball season, I would drive back and forth to Mobile, my hometown. And I would go to Birmingham and Montgomery, and there were National Guards standing on the corners, and to deal with that going home, and all of a sudden you say, you know, things are not right. Things are not right. I think the bus boycott was going at that time, and later on, you know, when I started playing baseball. We were having an exhibition game. We were going to play an exhibition game, 68. We playing an exhibition game over in Lafayette, Indiana. And I remember coming back from spring training. And as I walked in the hotel, unpacking my bag, and it came over the television that Martin Luther King had passed away. So it really hurt it, because here's a guy, you know, preaching nonviolence, trying to correct the country that everybody was, you know, doing their own thing. And he tried to correct the country, and he was killed. And it was tough at that time. You know, you think about those things. Now, in a situation like this, here's a kid that, you know, was in Minnesota. And it was said that a $20 bill he walked in, it was supposed to be a counterfeit $20 bill. And all of a sudden, you know, he dies on the knee of an individual who has been on the police force 18 years. And 17 years, he'd been disciplined. And we don't find out this particular thing, how this person is still being a policeman. And those are the kind of things you think about.
No question. I want to ask you about your relationship with Shirley. And I know she's had a real tough time here. How long have you been married?
We've been married... 60 years.
Wow. Congratulations.
Last February the 25th, we
Amazing.
Were married 60 years.
Amazing.
And I remember when I went to AAA to play baseball, that's when we got married.
Well, let's bring her into this conversation, because I'm sure you and Shirley had a lot of these talks mm-hmm. about what was going on in the world at that time. And I have no doubt that she counseled you through some of these tough times.
Well, she did. She did. And she saw me playing in Houston. And I remember Lou Johnson and I, we made it to AAA. Lou Johnson's wife was there. We were staying at the Mingo Motel in Houston, Texas. We were staying on Sunnyside. And Jay, you probably know what Sunnyside is in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Shirley and Lou Johnson's wife, they couldn't sit in their stands with other wives. So they were sitting down the first baseline and behind some chicken wire. And so that night after the game, we started discussing, you know, what it was like to be the, you know, the individuals to sit there and watch the game and see everybody else having fun. And we had to do that. And there were times in Chicago, you know, if I go in a place, they look at me and they don't know who I am. Until I got established, they didn't know who I am or were. But all of a sudden, they find out this is Billy Williams play with the Cubs. And I could see the difference how I was approached at the time when I was just a black person. Or next time, they know that I played baseball for the Cubs. So it was a different in that era.
So the situation where your wives had to sit in a different part of the stadium, was that just the stadium itself was segregated, like white people sat over here and black people sat over here?
This is true. This is true. Yeah, yeah. We couldn't sit. Shirley and them couldn't sit with the white wives. They had to sit in a little section that was made for Shirley and Lou Johnson's wife, because they were only two black wives on the baseball team. And so they had to sit down.
And I'm assuming it would have been a pretty courageous act for one of the white wives to go over and join your wives. They were probably, even if they were inclined to do so, they were probably afraid of the pushback they would get from, you know, stadium officials or whomever.
Well, that was the case. That was the case. You know, they were separated and they stayed separated. They couldn't go over there. It's just like, you know, when we were in Arizona, and it was a tough time out there trying to get a place to live. And I think when you walk around and you see places, you see signs saying, you know, for rent. So you walk up and try to get a place to live in Mesa, Arizona. And all of a sudden, the saying was that we will rent you this place. We will rent you this place. But I don't know how the tenants will accept it, the other tenants in the thing. And, of course, this is kind of like what happened when we were sitting in the stands at the Houston Stadium.
It's just heartbreaking. Billy, thank you for opening up on these often difficult topics and you know, as I said, I think we have made some progress, but we have a long, long way to go.
Yeah, we do. We have a long way to go, but I think we're at the crossroad now. Mm-hmm. And what happened the other day there were three or four people killed black people killed the other day. But I think one of the things that happened, and now this has been going on for a long time. This kind of prejudice been going along for a long time. When people getting shot, when people getting killed, and all of a sudden the police report is different. What happened? You know, he was aggressive. But now with the cell phones, you know, everybody got a cell phone now. Yeah. And I think this is what happened in the last couple of days, last week, and happened in the last year. And I think you'll begin to see this kind of thing happening now. You can't do anything wrong now and get by. You got to do the right thing. You got to treat people as they are. You know, you got to accept people. Yep. And this is the thing we got to do. And I think this is the turning point happened in the last, I guess, 3 weeks. When I see, as I said, when I see white people, black people, brown people, young people, old people, walking, marching, and trying to you know, get the country at its best. Because as I would travel around, and I see police cars, and on those police cars, I remember seeing serve and protect. But that has gone out the window from time to time. That's what they're there for, to serve and protect. And because of the camera, they begin to do that now. Yep. Because they can't do wrong and get by.
Yep. One last question on this particular topic, Billy. You're speaking of the wives being separated during the game, and JD mentioning that the courage it would have taken for one of the wives of the white ball player to come over. And if there's no specific person that stands out, that's fine. But was there a teammate or someone along the way, a white teammate of yours, who you thought showed a lot of courage and specifically and very visibly tried to break that tension and make sure that you knew that you were his teammate just like everybody else?
I think one of the guys I mentioned his name to start with was Jim Brewer. He was from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma.
Yep.
And Jim Brewer and I got along real well. When we were playing Class D League down in Ponca City, Oklahoma. And then eventually he played with the Cubs. And eventually he went to Dodgers. So when we would go to Los Angeles, he would pick me up and we'll go fishing when we was in Los Angeles. And when he played here, we go to Houston. We would go fishing in Houston. We would go to Galveston. So I thought he was pretty close. He was a guy that I could trust. I could, you know, talk to. And I enjoyed being with him. Matter of fact, his wife made mention of when I was playing in Ponca City, and an article came out, and she talked about Jim Brewer and myself, how we got along and how we enjoyed each other, because an incident happened down in Ponca City when I was playing down there, and things happened, and she said Lou was a real good friend of mine, and we got along real well.
That's great. That's great. Let's talk some baseball. You mentioned you stuck with it in 1959, and a couple of years later, you would be the National League Rookie of the Year. Billy, you were a very modern player, and I think a lot of what you did was appreciated, but a lot of what you did wasn't. You walked 1,045 times. You struck out 1,046, and you were a power hitter. So I'm sure the strikeouts today bother you to no end, but on-base percentage was not something that was discussed widely back then. You had a career 361 on-base percentage. So in terms of taking walks, did you seek it out, or was it simply if a guy didn't challenge you, you would just take your base and hand it to the next guy in the lineup?
Well, I think the biggest thing, I hit strikes. You know, when guys hit strikes, I swing the bat. And it was the thing when I first come to the big league, I was hitting third and Ernie was hitting fourth. So with Ernie hitting those home runs, you know, I told myself, I got to get on base for Ernie. And there were times, you know, I maybe went up to take a walk where Ernie could swing the bat. But most of the time, you know, talking to Rogers Hornby, and we talked really about when you play baseball, when you as a hitter, you're going to get one good pitch to hit. And when you get that pitch, don't miss it. So I was pretty a strike, ball strike hitter. I swung the bat, but I made sure the ball is over the plate. At that time, it was a home pitch to your knees, you know, a wider strike zone. But I was pretty disciplined at the plate. And I think one thing that happened because I realized I could get the bat to the ball quick, and that allowed me to wait a little longer than the average guy, I guess. And I used the whole field. So I didn't worry about taking a walk. I just wanted to, you know, do what I could to help the baseball team win.
Sounds so easy, doesn't it, JD?
Well, the thing that strikes me, one of the many things that strikes me in that answer was, you know, the approach, the mindset. But then Rogers Hornby, you know, I think baseball fans, when there's certain magical names, and you think back the long history of the game, and Rogers Hornby, you know, considered by many to be the best right-handed hitter of all time. So what was Hornby like? Was that, you know, I heard he was a little bit of a tough edge.
Oh, Ronnie.
When you talk about him, he had five wins. And I don't know who the other three were because he had Ryan and I down in AA baseball. He really taken liking to us. In spring training, he worked with myself and with Ronnie. And I guess you heard the story of when we were trying to revise the Cubs organization, John Holland had him to go to different minor leagues to see the baseball players. And when he came to San Antonio, and he had us work out and had everybody else sit in the stand, the whole team sit in the stand. And he often told guys, hey, listen, you could go home and get a job, you know. And Sano and I was sitting up there, and he looked at us and said, you guys could play in the big league right now, you know. So he came back and told John Holland, said, listen, he said, I'm going to see every minor league club down there. You have some good players down there, but you don't have players that possibly could play in the big league. You have two guys. You have Ron Sano and Billy Williams. And I think you could bring them up pretty soon. And, you know, he knew players. He knew players. But he was a tough hombre, man. Yeah, he was a good hitter, though.
Yeah, great. One of the all-time greats. You're right. We're chatting with Hall of Famer Billy Williams. And back to our conversation after a quick word from our sponsor. Here's to the road ahead. Trust Toyota to be here for you. A Toyota hybrid will give you the confidence to go farther than ever. Enjoy advanced tech in the Camry Hybrid. Load up the family in the roomy Highlander Hybrid. Or adventure in the RAV4 Hybrid, the best hybrid SUV for the money. And right now, get 0% financing on every Toyota hybrid. All from the brand you trust. Today, tomorrow, Toyota. View U.S. News best cars at cars.usnews.com on 2020 hybrid models, terms available on approved credit through participating dealers and Toyota Financial Services. Not all customers will qualify, void where prohibited. Offer ends July 6th, 2020. All right, Billy, 1,117 consecutive games played. You did not miss a game in seven seasons, a National League record at the time. That's stunning to me. Did you have moments where you were asked to take a day off and you said no chance?
You know, let me tell you about how all this stuff happened, okay? I came up from AA baseball. And I played a little bit when I was in AA baseball. So the following year, I went down to AAA baseball and had a great year. I think it was about 320. I hit 320 in AAA. So I got a chance to come to big league the next year, the following year. And this was 1961. And I started off playing. And after having great AA baseball years and great AAA, and I get to the big league, and I started to struggle, and I was sitting on the bench. I sit on the bench. They took me out of lineup. I sit on the bench, and a guy by the name of Bob Will took my job. He was playing, and sitting on the bench, I took a lot of stock of myself. I said, when I get back in the lineup, I say they're gonna have to tear this uniform off because I'm not getting out of there again. So you go through stages. You go through stages of playing. First of all, I was afraid of somebody taking my job. I wanted to be in the lineup. I was afraid of that. I wanted to play because I had witnessed that, you know, not having a good start, and I sit on the bench. The second phase of it, you know, you say, the baseball team can't win unless I'm in the lineup. So that took me through more games. And then you get to a stage, the third stage is, you get in 1,000 games. So you just sit, how many games can you play without coming out of the lineup? I knew I wasn't going to break Lou Gehrig's record, but I just wanted to play as many games as I could. And there are many times that you know, I talked to teammates, from other teams too. They said, man, you playing every day. Aren't you tired? I said, no, I love this game. I really enjoy playing the baseball. So if I had listened to those guys, you know, I wouldn't have played in that many games. And the one thing I could really appreciate what Cal Ripken went through. And because I bet he had had conversation with different players also, telling him, "Man, you're playing a lot. You know, you shouldn't play that many games." And Cal loved the game too, and that's why he was in that playing, breaking Lou Gehrig's record.
Do you think anybody was resentful? Like, you're making us look bad, man. You're playing every day, and that makes it hard for me to take a day off.
probably is. Let me see. I'm trying to remember this individual name, and he played in a few baseball games. You know, about 50 or 60 games straight, and we was in the shower. Mumphrey. Yeah, I got his name. Mumphrey.
Oh, Jerry Mumphrey.
We was in the shower one day, and we were showering together, and he said, "Man, I'm tired. Man, I'm tired." And he had played in about 50 games. You know, he was a utility player.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Mumph, I know just how you feel after I got to that 1,000 games." He said, "I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry I ever said that." But it was just enjoyed playing baseball. I was more comfortable on the baseball field than sitting in the dugout. I remember the day I did take the off day. I remember coming to the ballpark that morning, and Joey Mafitana said that, Leo got you out of lineup today. And I didn't know. I didn't say nothing. I said, "Well, this is a good time to take the day off." And I went in the clubhouse. The team was on the field. The baseball game started. I was in the clubhouse. Second inning, I came to the dugout. I sit there a while. The fifth inning, I went to the bullpen. The sixth inning, I went back to the dugout. I didn't know what to do with myself. You know, after being in playing that many games, there was always a time I come in the clubhouse and I was hitting third. Leo had me hitting third, and I knew what I had to do that day, take a little batting practice and play the game. So that's how I get myself for those 162 games. Matter of fact, Sano and I played 164 games one year.
That's right. Because of rainouts or makeups,
We had to go back to Pittsburgh, I think, and play another couple of games there. And yeah. I don't think people ask, how do you guys play 164 games? We just had to finish the season to see who was going to finish fourth.
We had fourth place money, yeah.
Oh yeah.
When fans see that a Rizzo or a Baez or a Bryant is out of the lineup and his manager says, you know, "Don't even put your spikes on. I'm not even going to use you in a big spot." And typically Joe would, game on the line, you know, bring Rizzo up in the 10th inning. But I think one of the reasons that they say, you know, "I'm not going to use you at all today" is exactly what you said. And Derek Lee once said it to me, like, "If I'm going to be off today, why do I even come to the ballpark?" Because his point was, if I have to go to work, I want to work. And sometimes you have to tell a player of your caliber, "I'm not going to hit you if we're in the 25th inning. You are not playing today," just to make sure that you get that day off, right?
I think if the baseball player knows that, I think it'd be a little easier for him and be a little easier for the manager. You know, he could say, and I've seen that happen. You know, guys said, "You're not going to play today. Go home. You know, don't even come to the park tomorrow. Just stay home." And this is when you get rest, because you're not going to get any rest when you come to ballpark. You be around the baseball players, and they're out there hitting, and you're gonna go out there and see what they're doing. You're going to come back in the clubhouse. And if you just stay home, you could do different things, enjoy your family, go out there, and you come back the next day ready to play the game with a new energy.
You played with the A's at the end of your career. You were able to get into the postseason for the only time in your career. But I'm going to ask you a strange question. played in some ballparks those last 2 years that you probably had never seen before. Mm-hmm. Were there any American League parks you were particularly excited to see and play in, since you had spent your entire career in the National League? And as we know, this was decades before interleague play.
I guess the old ballpark, Fenway Park in Boston, because it was one of the older ballparks that in the big league. And, of course, Yankee Stadium. I got a chance to play in Yankee Stadium. And it was a baseball park that when you walk in, immediately you think about the individuals who played there. When you walk in Yankee Stadium, you think about Yogi Berra, Babe Ruth, and people like that. And of course, when you walk in Fenway Park in Boston, you know, you think about Ted Williams, all those individuals who played there. You shrimps, we battled for the batting title down in AAA. And those two ballparks, I think I was really, really excited when looking on the schedule and saying that we're going to Boston to play, or we're going to play in Yankee Stadium. You're excited by going in there because you think about those ballparks have been around a long time and you just enjoy playing in them. And I think you give an extra, I wouldn't say an extra effort, but you feel good playing in those ballparks.
How was a little extra energy, just,
yeah,
historic. A lot of the way a lot of players feel like when they come into Wrigley.
Yeah, they do. You know, when they come into Wrigley, you're playing in a ballpark, been around a long time, and, you know, there's a lot of history in those ballparks, and it's exciting. Another ballpark, when we used to go to Candlestick Park, you know, it was one of the older ballparks, and when you playing in there, I know playing against Willie Mays, you wanted Willie Mays to look at you. You look at the Willie Mays, but you wanted Willie Mays to look at you, too. And it was just exciting because Willie McCovey, you know, my hometown friend, he's played with the Giants too, and we just enjoyed playing against each other. But those three ballparks, I think I enjoyed playing the game. And, of course, Dodger Stadium too, because I was really a Dodger fan. I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan, and simply because of Jackie Robinson. I followed the Dodgers, and Duke Snider was my hero. He was a left-handed hitter. He's hit the ball, you know, high, wide, and handsome. And I say, I want to do that one day. So, but most of all, the two ballparks most enjoyed playing in was Yankee Stadium and Fenway Park in Boston.
Yeah. You mentioned some of the all-time greats you played with and against. Who stood out the most when you were on the same field? Was it Willie Mays? Was it Ernie? I mean, the one guy where you said to yourself, this is the best baseball player I've ever seen.
Well, it's got to be Willie Mays.
Yeah.
It's got to be Willie Mays. I've seen that guy, you know, he played in center field. And, you know, I hit balls. He played me like straight away a little bit toward the right field. And I hit balls in the left field because I used the whole field. And when he going at the ball and he pat his glove, you could go back to the bench because that's when he got the ball. You know, when he's wide open running, catching the baseball, and he was something. He was a 5-2 player. I mean, he was a 6-2 player because he could do so many things. I remember they were telling me that you know, Juan Marichal was going to pitch, and they thought they were stealing the signs from, I think it was Jack Hyde or somebody catching. And Willie said, I will call the pitches from center field. And he called all the pitches the pitcher should throw from center field. And it was something to see that guy. I think he was born to play baseball, let's say that.
Yeah.
I've seen
him. What about the
I've seen him run around first base, and he's on first base, and a guy hit a baseball to right field, and he hit second base, and he'd be looking at the ball in right field, and he touched third base. He go right to third base, put his foot right on top of third base, looking in the right field. I've seen that happen with him so many times.
Hmm. What about Henry Aaron? He's from your part of the world, right?
Yes, he is. He's great, too. Henry's great, too. And, you know, we got a chance to play against each other when I used to go to Atlanta. there were several people, two or three buses come over from Mobile to watch us play. You know, they couldn't root for me and they couldn't root for Aaron. They just said, I'm a root for the boys from Mobile.
Yeah, that's a pretty fertile area, right? There's a number of guys from Mobile.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of good players from Mobile. And, you know, started Satchel Paige was from Mobile. And Double Duty Radcliffe. And recently, not recently, but a few years back, the Mets had three guys from Mobile they put in the outfield one time. That was Amos Otis, Cleon Jones, and Tommy Agee. And they were three guys playing in the outfield at the time. But McCovey, Aaron, Milton, Frank Bowling, and who else? I'm forgetting a lot of guys.
Well, a more recent vintage, Jake Peavy, right? Jake Peavy's from Mobile.
Who?
Jake Peavy.
Jake Peavy? Jake Peavy's from the same hometown as the guy used to pitch for the Cubs, Jake Peavy. We had a hard-throwing guy. I'm trying to think of his name. And the guy pitched for San Diego. He was a starter for us, and then he went to San Diego.
Oh, I'll come up with it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm 82 years old now. You know what I'm saying?
Hey, I'm 49. I'm very forgetful.
Yeah. My grandson keep me posted. But we have a lot of players. I remember one year, you know, right before we went to spring training, we didn't do anything, but AG, myself, and Tommy Agee, we used to go to bowling alley and bowl. That's the heaviest thing I picked up during the winter. And, of course, just before the spring training start, we would call around. We would call around and said, we're going to take some batting practice. We're going to get ready to go to spring training. And each guy, you know, each day we have a couple, two or three rounds. And then afterwards, we go sit in the stands at Carver Stadium where Aaron was born. And we sit in the stand, and, of course, Aaron talked baseball, tell us about the pitching and everything in the big league. And, you know, we did that for about 2 or 3 weeks, and all of a sudden we say, we'll see you down the road, man. Yeah. So we took off, and we went to spring training, and as the baseball season started, that's the next time we saw the guys from Mobile.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about Roberto Clemente.
Clemente had one of the greatest arms I ever seen in the game of baseball. There are a picture of me going from first base to third, and I thought I had it made easy. And the ball was up against the wall, and he threw the ball about 2 or 3 feet from right field wall into third base. And as you know, the guy tagged me out, and I was out. But Clemente was a great player. He played the game hard, and he did so many great things on the baseball field. I think the one time that one thing that happened when he played in the World Series, I think that was a stage for Clemente because he had such good World Series, and a lot of people knew at that time what kind of player he was. Mm-hmm. He was a guy that used the whole field. He stood way off the plate. And everybody was saying that the pitchers would say, well, I'm going to throw him outside. If they did that, I'm playing right field. I got to be ready because he could hit the ball to right field just like a left-handed hitter. And I remember a couple of times they said, well, if he that good on the outside part of the plate, maybe he couldn't hit the ball inside. So they threw the ball inside. He probably hit it over left field. And he ran good. It was you know, it wasn't a smooth run. It was a violent run, you know, but he got the job done. He was pretty fast. He, Aaron, and Willie Mays, that kept me off the All-Star team a few years because they were.
Yeah. Pretty powerful group to try to break in against.
Yeah, trying to break in to play to make the All-Star team. You know, those guys did it every year.
Yeah.
Hey, I got a trivia question for you, Billy.
Okay.
Who is the pitcher that you hit the most home runs off in your career?
Oh, that's easy. That's Bob Gibson. Don't say that too loud, though.
He might take a shot at you still, huh?
You know, yeah, you know Bob Gibson, that honorary sucker. Yeah, he stood on the mound and he really said, "I'm gonna get him out with this pitch. I'm gonna get him out with this pitch." And he had that good slider piece down and in, and he was pitching right to my power. And as he threw it down there, I would swing and hit the ball out the ballpark. But it was just one of those things. I saw him real good.
Did he ever back you off the plate? Did he ever try to intimidate you?
Yeah. Well, that was his thing, you know. You couldn't hit two home runs off him. Nobody could hit two home runs off him.
You hit one.
You hit one, and you better run back to the dugout, you know. Like guys now flip the bat and all that stuff. Nuh-uh. Not on gift. But you used to see that a lot. You know, you could hit one home run, but two home runs, and you show the pitcher up. The next time you come up, you knock down. But that was the game. That's how we played the game at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember, I think it was Art Howe telling a story as a young player, and he hit a home run off Gibson, and he put his head down, and he sprinted around the bases. And when he got in the dugout, he wouldn't look out, and he just kept asking, "Is he looking in here? Is he looking at me? Is he?"
That's kind of like Nolan Ryan too. You know, you bunt on Nolan Ryan, he walk over there and pick up the ball and look at your heart, and that was it, man. That was it. But yeah, you didn't do that. You didn't do that. Mm-hmm. I remember we was in a game one day. The Cardinals playing here, the St. Louis Cardinals playing here, and Bob was throwing the ball, seemed like it was taking off a little high and everything. And Tim McCarver jumped up and called timeout, and he started coming to the mound, and Bob Gibson waved him back, said, "Go back. Go back. Don't come out here. The only thing you know about pitching, you can't hit it." Yeah. But Bob was a guy that, you know, when you face him, you had a battle. And I think the one thing that happened with Fergie and Bob Gibson pitching, the game didn't last long. I always make it a plan to do something after the game because you knew the game was going to be like 2 hours, 2.5 hours. It wasn't going to be that long.
Right, right.
Now they got
really one of the most cherished photographs I have is from spring training about 10 years ago in the dugout between Ron Santo and Billy Williams. And I often think about how much Ronnie would have loved the 2016 World Champs. I think a lot about how Ernie would have adored that team as well. We sadly lost one of your teammates, Glenn Beckert, recently. But what a great group of guys. And I think it's been just awesome that they've all been able to be around the ballpark and sing the stretch and, you know, all the great Hall of Famers. Lee Smith now is in that group of Hall of Famers. It's really been an amazing group of Cubs alumni, hasn't it?
It really have. And of course, you mentioned Ronnie and you mentioned Ernie. And, you know, like Fergie. But I'm mostly thinking about Ernie and Ron Santo. And when Rizzo caught that ball and put it in his back pocket, immediately I thought of Ernie and I thought about Santo. How many times they went to the ballpark, hitting home runs, try to get Cubs in the World Series. And Ernie always said, "We're going to win. We're gonna win this year. We're going to be there this year." So I immediately thought about those guys. I said, what would have been nice if they had been here to help me celebrate this thing? Because it was so exciting. And, you know, I thought about those guys.
Let's end on a high note. You've got a birthday coming up. What, 39?
Yeah, Jack Benny. That's what I used to say. But I'll be 72, 82 when my birthday come up. I try to get 72. But I'll be 82 years old, and seemed like it was just yesterday I was playing baseball, and it seemed like it was just yesterday I was running. And, you know, I being 82 years old, time go by so fast, and it has been a really, you know, a great thing to have that many years under your belt.
Well, one of the great things for JD and me when we get to Wrigley Field is when we see Billy Williams in the dugout. Man, it just is so good to see you all the time. And I hope it happens again here in a few weeks. Take care of Shirley and your family. And thank you so much for your time.
I sure will. And you guys take care. And then we're going to look for baseball in the next, I guess, next 3 weeks. We got to start this season up because a lot of people are hungry for baseball. I know when we left the convention, I know everybody was excited going to spring training. And most of the time, you're ready for the season. And all of a sudden, because this coronavirus, everything has stood still. And everybody began to be in a wait-and-see mode. And I think basketball, football, baseball, people wanted to see that on television. And I think we're going to do that in the next few, next 3 weeks. We can't wait too long in baseball, though.
That's right. Thanks, Billy.
Thanks, Billy.
Thank you, guys. You guys take care. Stay safe.
Be well. Right.
What a guy, Billy Williams. As he mentioned, he'll turn 82 in a few days. And man, I always love being around the batting cage, JD, with Billy, as he can break down a swing. He can see a guy in BP take like three swings and he can tell you what type of hitter he is.
Yeah, he's so much fun to talk to. I remember one day talking to him about the launch angle, and he goes, I don't believe in launch angle. It's just if the pitch was high, I just put a flat swing on it and hit it out of the ballpark. He didn't overthink it, but he had such a beautiful short stroke and was such an accomplished hitter. And unlike many who are really great, he could teach it. You know, a lot of great players aren't good coaches, but Billy was. And for me, I've been around a lot of people around this game, and I'm not going to pretend to know Billy intimately. But he's one of the nicest guys I've ever been around at a ballpark. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, there's no question. One other note about Billy, and this tells you about the era in which he played. He was the Cubs' first $100,000 a year ball player, and I think it was 1971 or 72. And that was a huge deal at the time to get to six digits. And I mentioned in our interview, JD, that Billy was a very modern ball player in that he had a high on-base percentage. What would his slash line be worth today on the open market?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he'd be a $30 million a year player. And Ronnie Santo was the same way. Santo was undervalued. He was a guy who walked a ton. And so two guys that were modern players, as you mentioned, with that skill set of patience, discipline, and power.
The Major League Draft was last night. We are recording this podcast actually prior to the draft. We're recording on Wednesday afternoon. So, I was thinking about asking you to tell us who the Cubs picked and to see if you could first guess it. But I'm guessing you have not broken down the draft very specifically. They have the 16th pick in the first round. And then I think the biggest thing with this draft is not only it's a virtual draft, but five rounds and then kind of a free-for-all for free agents, but only a $20,000 cap to sign those guys.
Right. So it's obviously a very strange time to be an amateur player. And I think a lot of kids coming out of high school that might have been inclined to sign will go to college. I think a lot of college juniors will go back for their senior year, as opposed to signing those $20,000 free agent contracts. And, I think rounds one through five will probably look very much like drafts have in previous years. But, yeah, then it's a crapshoot after that. It's unfortunate because of the economics of the game and the virus and everything else that's going on that this has come to pass. But it's another asterisk in the record books for baseball during the era of the coronavirus.
At last check, the Players Union and Major League Baseball continue to swap offers. They've all essentially been rejected at this point. I suppose if a miracle occurred, there was a deal before we started or aired this podcast this week. I would like to think by our next podcast next week, JD, there will be a deal of some kind. You would hope it's a negotiated agreement, but in the end, if no such thing occurs, it sounds like the commissioner is going to say, this is going to be our season. Let's go.
Right. The players back in March agreed to you know, a season that would pay them a, you know, 100% or, you know, a prorated salary for the number of games played. The sticking point is obviously the players have pushed for more games, which would mean more salary. The clubs have said no, they don't want to play as many games. They want to make sure the regular season ends in September. They don't want to commit that much money to the players. So I think that's probably the most likely outcome of this, that the commissioner ends up saying, here's the schedule, let's go play ball. I've heard rumors of 48 to 54 games. I hope it's more than that. You know, something close to half a season feels, you know, a lot like more like baseball to me than a 50 game season does. So we'll see. You're right. I think we will play. Just how much we'll play, nobody really knows the answer yet.
I think we were remiss the last time around in doing our weekly admission. So I will go first this week, and I'm this. We're digging deep here. I haven't been able to get out of bed before 8 o'clock during this shutdown in the morning. Now I wake up every morning well before eight, and I typically contemplate getting on with my day, and then I remember I don't have anything to do until 1:30 or 2:30 or on the early side 10:30, and I just linger and I don't get up. What's wrong with me?
Nothing. I think that's perfectly normal. I think that's what probably most people are experiencing. Yeah, there needs to be a name for it, some kind of a syndrome, like there's too much time in the day syndrome because you don't know what to do with yourself if you get up. Well, I haven't had that problem here because we're on the river and the sun comes beating in through the windows at about 4:30 in the morning and the birds are chirping. So it's been kind of early wake-up call for me since we've been up here. General admission confession. It struck me because back here in my hometown, I got thinking about my younger days. And I think it's fairly unique to this little town that I'm from in northern New York. You know, people, if they go out on the town and they might enjoy a couple of adult beverages, a lot of times they'll go eat afterwards and they'll go to a diner. Well, the food of choice when I was like college age and beyond was macaroni salad with gravy slathered all over it.
Ooh.
Yeah, it wasn't even a special order. It was on the menu and you could even get a double order if you wanted. I think it was a mac salad and you throw another nickel in there and you get gravy poured all over it. By golly, didn't that feel good the next day?
Oh, that sounds like the kind of thing you can only eat after midnight.
Yeah, it must be, it's probably related. It's probably like poor man's poutine or something like that. I don't know the origins of it, but man, it was good.
Open Concessions presented by Toyota. A special thanks to Matt Romito, Daniel Green, Jim Obojkovic, Max Berman, Joe Rios, Adam Sobel, and for JD, I'm Len. Make sure you subscribe, rate, review, and share it with your friends. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.